your new franchise.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Tea Party Podcast. It's the podcast where you find new friends and new music. And this week I'm joined by a guy that's really done it all in the entertainment industry, from being a tour manager for everybody's favorite cable guy to radio station programming. This North Idaho native's work has been nominated for a Grammy, and his fan base spans the entire globe. And that's just what I could fit into 20 seconds. Let's welcome to the show the one and only Jeremy McComb. Jeremy, man, how the heck are you?
Man, I'm wonderful. Thank you. That was I need you to go everywhere with me with that intro.
I do what I can.
It's awesome.
Well, thank you. And guys, before we get too far into it, this week's episode is brought to you by our friends over at Audible. They're offering a special deal for everybody listening to the podcast. They're giving you a free month of Audible access and a free book just for signing up, and you can cancel anytime you want. And you might be thinking, Ty, isn't a free audiobook basically the same as free access for a month? And the answer is no, not with Audible. It's so much more than just thousands of audiobooks. They've got wellness plans, live productions, original content, and even podcasts now, including this one. So head on over to audibletrial.com/teaparty. Sign up for that free trial. Get your free book and check it out. That's audibletrial.com/TEEPARTY.
It's time to tee off with Ty and today's guest, Jeremy McComb. Here comes the first four. And
you now? Put the party in tea party, man.
Well, I appreciate that, man. Well, here, let's just jump right into it then with question one of the first four. If you couldn't be in the entertainment industry, Jeremy, what job would you have?
Oh, man, you know, I really don't know. I've done nothing but this my entire life. Since I was 5 years old, it was all I wanted to do. I think if I had to choose something outside of this, I enjoy helping people. And so I don't know, man, maybe a police officer.
You sound so sure of that answer.
Yeah, I don't know. Like that would be the one thing that would come to mind of, like, you know, immediate being able to help people. And yeah, I really don't know. I would find a way into this business somehow. It's been my only passion.
To be fair, these questions are a little tough just because they make you think outside the box a little bit.
I like that.
This one's pretty straightforward, though.
All right.
Sort of. What's your favorite song of all time?
That is not straightforward.
I said sort of.
It's so... That, for me, like, it gets whittled down into subgenre categories. I mean, there's so many songs I've listened to where I'm like, this might be the greatest song ever written. I can say the greatest song that I think ever recorded is an easy one for me, which is Stand By Me by Benny King. And the reason is there's something magic. Like, I don't understand. I had this conversation the other day. I don't understand how telephones work. I don't understand how recording works. I don't know how we take our voice and we put it, this Zoom call right now, I have no idea how this is working, but I'm thankful that it is. But how we can capture something magical that happens in a room and share it to people all around the world forever, years and years after we're gone. There was something so magic in the room happening on Stand By Me by Benny King that, to me, it's just undeniably the best song ever recorded. Not the best song, and I mean that in a recording sense, but ever written, there's just too many. I mean, Poncho and Lefty, there's just too many. I don't know. Every song by Jim Croce, I don't know.
That may be the most full circle answer that we've gotten, and I feel like I need to replace that question now because I don't know that we're going to get a better answer than that.
Well, good. Question.
There you go. That one is always the Jeremy McComb question from now on.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
How about this one? What character from TV or a movie would you bring to life if you could?
A fictional character?
Yep.
To bring to life from TV or a movie, I would say Walter from The Big Lebowski.
Ooh, that's a good answer. In this fictional world, are you the Big Lebowski then?
I think I would probably be Donnie.
Okay, here we go. Last question of the first four. Okay. If you could have an unlimited supply of anything, whiskey, tacos, guitar strings, scotch tape, whatever, what would it be? And it can't be money or money-making machines.
No, it would be just time with my wife and kids.
There you go. This is a great, wholesome answer. Wrap up the first four. I love it, Jeremy.
Yeah, we're good. All right.
Crush those.
Crushed it.
Now let's get into actually talking about you. And let's just start with like a high level Cliff Notes kind of version of growing up in North Idaho and how you got into music.
Yeah. So spent my entire life around music. I'm a fifth or sixth generation musician. And so I was always just around it. My dad had a really popular band. I guess it was a family band, really. Cause my mom was in it. My brother was in it, and it was a band called Crossfire, and they played regionally around the Northwest and were probably the most popular band in our little region at that time. And he was playing six nights a week. So I grew up sleeping behind my dad's amp in clubs. And the minute that I saw my dad work a crowd, my dad was a master entertainer, still is. And it was just one of those things where I was like, this is what I have to do. And so I started, you know, honing my skills in class as a class clown and getting thrown out of school and, you know, just all the things that go with it of just, you know, not doing the correct things. And then at 16 years old, left and started playing full time with a band up there called the Kelly Hughes Band. And that was kind of really my high school and my college and all that, because that was where I really learned the fundamentals of how to play and how to entertain and how to put all the things that I watched my dad do and I watched Kelly Hughes do. And I started to learn this business in a really real way at 16 years old when I left school.
Do you remember your first time on stage as an artist yourself?
Like as an artist?
Like as somebody... where somebody came to see you, not necessarily, you know, jumping up there with your pops or Kelly Hughes.
Yeah. Yeah. I started a band when I was 13 called the Class of 56. And that was like, we were doing our own songs. It was a very weird scenario because it was a bunch of 13-year-olds dressed like it was 1950. Because my cousin had this band called the Dempseys, and they were this incredible rockabilly band. And so I was trying to be different and trying to write songs, and I was writing songs about, you know, what I knew at that time, which was just crushes and girls not wanting anything to do with me and those types of things. So it was like, it was a very odd experience, but that was my first start playing in clubs. Me, a guy named Aaron Hayes. And then I talked my dad into playing bass because there were no bass players around.
Well, that makes it easy then.
Yeah. So,
always nice to know somebody that's got some talent there.
Yeah. Yeah. And God bless him for doing it because we were terrible. God, we were terrible.
Well, so then moving away from the music just for a second, you worked in radio here in Spokane for a while. And I used to hate this question when I was in radio because I feel like everybody and their mother asks it. So I'm going to ask you this question and add a little bit to it. How did you end up in radio? Was it on purpose or did you just kind of stumble into the opportunity? Because I feel like there's kind of two groups out there and everybody falls into one of them.
Yeah, totally on purpose. So I was playing at Kelly's at the time. And Kelly's was the big honky tonk in town. For people who don't know, it's now Nashville North, but it was Kelly's at that time. I was playing in his band. We were playing at a club up on the north side of Spokane one night called Swack Hammers. And Paul Newman, Coyote, was working at a radio station there, and he was the DJ that night. And he told me that he ran the radio station. And I said, well, I want to learn how things work. Cause for me, I was like, if I'm going to get to Nashville, I need to know everything about how this industry works. So I knew how the stage stuff worked, but I wanted to know, why did radio play certain songs and not other songs? And how did those songs get played on the radio? And how does the radio station work and all that stuff? So I went in and I just started doing stuff for free. You know, I was board hopping the morning show called Tim and Willie, which is based out of Phoenix. And from there, I started just being a sponge. I learned from everybody that I could. And slowly but surely, I started getting my own shows. Then I had my own shows on the weekends. And then I was the afternoon drive guy. And then ended up being like, I think at the time, I was the youngest music director the Clear Channel had. I was like 20 years old.
That's actually pretty impressive. Coming from... you know, the world of radio, you don't see that very often, young guys getting their chance to program stations like that, even now.
Well, And Paul was, Coyote was a huge part of that for me, because he was so willing to help me. And when I didn't have any money, he would help me get DJ gigs, and then he would go come drop off the gear and bring me music, because I didn't have any of the gear or the music. And he helped me learn how to program songs, or not program, but how to schedule songs and how to pick songs and how to do production, which I still do today. For our club and stuff, I do all the production for that just because I love it. And there's such a part of radio that I love. I miss the daily, afternoon drive where you would be on the air and you would be getting all these phone calls and playing requests when you could do that. You can't do that anymore. But when the interaction, the connection with people, and then learning that side of the business, it was a very, very direct way. And it was totally intentional to try to learn that side of the business. And then to get close to people who lived in Nashville to figure out how the hell I got there.
Well, I feel like that part worked out for you at least a little bit, because that's where you ended up for now. Yeah. But when you were in radio, you met this little guy named Larry.
Yeah.
How did that happen? What was that first interaction like? And then how did you end up being his tour manager?
I got, when you're a music director, you would get this huge stack of CDs. And now I would imagine it would be, emails, but MP3s. But I used to get these big stack of CDs every week in the mail of songs to listen to. And we would go through them and decide what we were going to add to the regular playlist. And one of the CDs that came through was this Larry the Cable Guy dude who was out opening for Jeff Foxworthy. They were doing the blue collar thing. It was pretty new. People were starting to hear about Larry the Cable Guy, but he wasn't like this, superstar that he became to be. It was, he was kind of the next up and coming guy in the redneck thing. And he was still opening for Jeff. So I put together a proposal. I was like, we got to bring this guy to Kelly's. We'll, maybe do a comedy night, see what happens. And I put together a huge proposal, took it to the radio station. I think he was going for $4,000 at that time. And the radio station wouldn't give me any money. So I went to Kelly and I asked him if I could borrow the money to bring him to the club. And he lent it to me and he let me book the show. And the show did well. And me and Larry kind of hit it off because Kelly was playing him a record that I had made in a band I had up there called Trace County with my brother and a guy named Greg Stevens. And we became friends. And then all of a sudden, Cable Guy would just start calling me. He'd be around the country and he'd be like, man, we're in Florida tonight. Everybody loves your music. And the next time he came through town, he said, we wrote a goofy song called Closing Time Crowd. And he said, why don't you come to Montana tomorrow night and play that thing on stage? And so I went, and he just made an off the cuff remark where he said, if you ever want to come out on the road for a week or whatever, let me know. I took that as an invitation, and I went home and bought an Amtrak train ticket with the last $100 that I had. I was totally broke, and rode an Amtrak for 4 days to get to Bloomington, Illinois, and got on his bus, was supposed to stay for 7 days, and ended up staying for 3-4 years, whatever it was, 3 years, I think.
That's kind of, that's impressive to go from just that, kind of building that up, but that's kind of been your entire career, even from when you were little, just making those connections and almost forcing people to be like, hey, listen to this. And then they do. And they're like, oh yeah, maybe this guy doesn't know what he's talking about a little bit.
Yeah. It's been crazy, and I've always been fortunate enough to just be in the room. And I think a lot of that comes from, I never said no to anything. And I still live that way now. Like people say, you want to do this? And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. And then we figure the rest of it out. And through that, I've gotten so many opportunities and things that I would have never had I just said, oh, well, he didn't mean to really come out on the road with him. He was just being nice. So I'm just going to go back home. And, I took him up on it and we became friends, and I started writing songs for him and writing goofy stuff for his albums. And because of that, when they started doing the blue collar comedy tour movies, they had paid a guy to do the soundtrack for it. And the guy didn't deliver the song. They were in need of a song and they needed it like in an hour. And Cable Guy was like, hey man, my road manager is a great songwriter. And just sitting in the room is what got me that gig. And then I wrote every song for the rest of that series for the soundtrack that we did originally. So it was just an amazing thing to be a part of. And to look back now, it still doesn't really hit me that, because at that time it was the biggest comedy tour in the world. It was the number 4th grossing tour in the world. And we were behind, I think, Green Day and Madonna and Elton John. It was
That's crazy.
It was insane.
Well, and that's how you earned a Grammy nomination for that, right?
The soundtrack was nominated for a Grammy, which I had written a couple songs on. So it's the Grammy nominated soundtrack, but it was, I was really, really proud to be part of that.
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's gotta be kind of a cool feeling, even, you know, if it's not your name specifically, being part of a project like that, that gets that kind of recognition, even not winning. I mean, just being nominated is a heck of a recognition.
Yeah. And then, and just being part of the biggest comedy tour in history at that time. It was insane. The amount of people that were coming out, and then to watch one of your friends go from an opening for Jeff in theaters in Bloomington, Illinois, to selling out, you know, the American Airlines Center in Dallas, or doing Husker Stadium. You know, it was crazy. That 3-year ride, that ascent of him was just insane. And I learned so much of road managing, promoting and touring, how to tour and how to connect with an audience. I stole so much stuff from watching Jeff Foxworthy and Ron White and Cable Guy every night. It was incredible.
Well, and so now we know, you know, you got the behind the scenes from the radio, then you've got the tour that you kind of learned along the way with the blue collar comedy stuff and Larry the Cable Guy. But when you were along with that tour, and anybody that's heard you play a show or listen to your live album knows that when you're up on stage, it's so much more than just music. Like it's a full on show. Was that something that you had been kind of perfecting before that tour, or did you add that with some of the pieces that you earned while you were out on the road?
You know, I think that I was always really drawn to storytellers, whether it be like Jim Croce or Todd Snyder or guys like that. Like I was always just so drawn to the story about the song and listening to the stories about it. And then learning how to craft a story, learning how to put a story together, and then adding, you know, the funny stuff to it. And I study comedy super heavy now. And I've found that that studying comedy has made me a better songwriter, I feel like. It's made me a better performer. It's made me a better entertainer. And, you know, people that aren't close in the comedy world will go, oh man, you know, you should do stand up. And it's like, no. Those guys are a whole different level. You know, when you see guys like Bill Burr and Sebastian, you know, Maniscalco and these incredible guys, George Carlin and Foxworthy and Cable Guy and Ron and all those dudes. But when you see the process of that, I'm not that, but I learned how to put together stories from my experiences that were funny. And from that, I stole a lot along the way of learning how to craft these stories. And so, yeah, that's a huge compliment, man. And I appreciate that, because I want the show to be immersive. I want you to feel like you're a part of it. I want people to laugh. I don't want people to take themselves too seriously. And my objective has always been, I want you to laugh in between the songs, and then I want you to listen to a great song. So if I'm writing, hopefully, great songs that people enjoy for my audience. And when I say great, I mean great for me. I'm not comparing myself to anyone else, but if I can write really great songs that touch people and have some laughs in between and doing the best I can do with those, then that's success for me.
Well, hey, you're doing pretty well, you know, with that kind of structure. And I mentioned it, so I want to ask you about this. You put out a live album a couple of years ago now, and anybody that's listened to it will hear exactly what you're talking about. But I've always wanted to ask you, why Boxcars in Wisconsin for a live album?
You know, it's just so immersive. That club, it's a great listening room. We actually recorded 3 shows. So we recorded 2 shows in Omaha, Nebraska, and then I had gone to play in Boxcars a week or two later, and I was like, man, the audio just wasn't great from the Omaha shows. It just wasn't there, and it didn't come across the way. And so I said, man, let's go back to Wisconsin and let's see what people think about doing it there. So we did it there, and I'm so glad that we went back and re-recorded it, because it's one of my proudest things. I always wanted to do a live record, and to have that kind of an audience and that kind of an immersive crowd where you just can say anything and you can lose yourself in it. Everybody's open and vulnerable and laughing, and it was just the best, man. There was a tornado going on outside, dude. It was fucking crazy. It was nuts, but it was incredible.
I feel like that kind of added to the excitement of,
oh, for sure. Of
listen, yeah. Not just recording it, but listening to it. You're like, oh, I wonder at what point this album gets cut off with that tornado he keeps talking about.
Well, and for real, like we could see the tornado before, like,
no.
Dan, my opener, was on stage, and I'm outside doing a video. It's probably on my Facebook somewhere. You can see the funnel cloud, and I'm like, dude, I guess if we're going to go, we go down swinging. And yeah. People's phones were going off with emergencies and shit. It was crazy, but it just turned into the whole troublemaker vibe, you know, and it was great. It was awesome.
Well, let's shift gears a little bit because I want to talk about your music. Now that we've talked about you and everybody kind of has a sense of where you came from and how you craft these things, we've got a couple of songs for everybody to kind of get a taste of what the Jeremy McComb sound is. And the first one we have for everybody, it's called Cotton's Getting High. You put it out towards the end of last year.
Yeah.
And it was written by some Nashville heavy hitters, Josh Osborne, Shane McAnally, Luke Laird. How did you end up recording this one, and how did the song kind of come together?
My producer is also my drummer and one of my best friends, Nick Gibbons. He had played me this song probably about 5 or 6 years ago off of a demo that another group had done. And I absolutely love the song. It's just a barn burner, you know? And so I was like, man, are they releasing that? Is that a thing? And then he's like, nah, the band's not even together anymore. It was like a demo project they did that never happened. And I was like, we should start doing that song live. And so we started playing it live, and we would get this crazy reaction from people that have never heard it before. But by the time it got to the second chorus, people were singing along and dancing. And because of the reaction, when we went in to record this record, I was like, we have to put Cotton on here. And so I owe that tune to Nick. He brought that thing to the forefront and produced the hell out of it. And it's so much fun to play.
Well, I've got more questions about it, but I want to let everybody take a listen to it first.
Yeah.
So here it is for everybody. It's called Cotton's Getting High by today's guest, Jeremy McComb.
In the light of the dashboard, appetite for destruction on the radio, play like a radio do. Out in the woods, you don't need a passport. Left at the light till the gravel's gone. Sun went down a couple hours ago. So fill up your cup, pull your hat down low. Everybody's wearing the cool shades, baby. Lighting up a Saturday night. Good enough tonight. Damn right. Out in the field in the low beam lights. just like candy. Thoughts that go around your head.
Yeah.
Everybody's wearing the cool shades, baby. Lighting up a Saturday night. Everybody's drinking the Kool-Aid, baby. More than just the cotton's getting high.
And that one was called Cotton's Getting High by Jeremy McComb. And you recorded a music video for this, and you actually recorded it out at the Nashville North, which we talked about. Yeah. Used to be Kelly's. Interestingly enough, you happen to be involved in the bar now. You went from playing on stage to now owning it. How did that happen?
Well, that building, you know, has given me everything. I grew up on McGuire Road in Post Falls, Idaho. I started playing in that club when it was Kelly's when I was 16. I met all my friends there. I met the best people on the planet in that place. I played with incredible musicians. I got the Larry the Cable Guy gig because of that. And then Kelly called me one day and he was like, man, the club, because it had turned into another bar for about 10 years. And he had called me and he said, hey, man, that business is done and it's run its course. And the club's just been sitting there empty for about 3 months. I don't know if you're interested in buying it. And I was like, dude, I live 2,000 miles away. What am I going to do with a bar? And I hung up the phone with him and I started thinking about it. And so I called one of my best pals on the planet, Bob Creeman. And Bob had just gotten this big state job with a liquor company, and I said, hey, what would you think about quitting that new cushy job with the great benefits and put hanging your balls out there and possibly losing everything we have, starting a bar? And he was like, yeah, let's do it. And so
it's a hard sell.
We just wanted to take everything that we had both experienced. You know, he's got 20 some years in the liquor distribution business. That he's a genius when it comes to the liquor distribution and those types of things. And he's also a great carpenter and he's got great vision. And I wanted to couple that with everything that I've seen in clubs around the country for the last 22 years and put in the things that we've seen that have worked, take out the things that we've seen that didn't work. We wanted to get back to, you know, the bar it was before was trying to do like five nights a week and it was doing all these different kinds of music. And we were like, look, we got to get back to the core of it, which is we're open two nights a week. We're only country. There are no rock bands in here. There's not going to be any, you know, hip hop Wednesdays or anything. It's a country honky tonk that we wanted to be a safe, fun environment where we could bring an actual Nashville experience or an Austin experience to, my hometown, you know? And so Bob and I worked really, really hard on figuring out what our scheme was going to be, from the logos to the colors inside the building to how we wanted to do things and what house band was going to be in there. And so it's just been a great labor of love, and we have the best staff, and Bob just does such an incredible job of running the day to day. And it's fun as hell. You know, I do all the entertainment stuff. So it's amazing to put my friends in our club, you know, to have Reckless Kelly up or to have Ned Ledoux up or, you know, I mean, Luke Combs and all these artists. We've had some incredible artists over the last 7 years that have come through and just exploded. So it really has just been a wonderful thing. And it's a great way to kind of try to get back to our community too. We do a lot of community stuff and to get back to that building, because that building has given me everything.
Well, and you guys, you know, when you announce a concert, It is probably the most popular thing that I see on my Facebook for 3 days, regardless of how quickly the tickets sell out. I mean, you guys just announced Jimmy Allen, his tickets went on sale and they were sold out in like 20 minutes.
Yeah, they went fast. I think it was like the 36 hours or something like that, but they go so fast. And then we've got, you know, people going like, how come I can't get any tickets? It's like, man, you got to get them fast. You know, we told people when Luke Combs went on sale, I think Luke Combs tickets were $10. And so, you know, we were like, look, the next time you see this guy, he's going to be in an arena. And our mission is to bring guys to town that you're going to see him maybe once or twice at our place. And then you're going to be, you know, you're going to be spending $70-$80 to go see him. So get in, get up close, get personal with these huge stars in the making. And it's been a really amazing thing. Coyote Country is a huge part of that too.
There's a great group of guys over there. So it makes it easy to work with somebody like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and you're not kidding. I mean, I'm just kind of running through my head at artists that I've seen there, and I'm like, yeah, no, they're at the arena now.
Yeah,
I mean, so it's really a real nice experience up here in the Northwest, because we don't get that as often here. I mean, you down in Nashville, you can go see these guys as they're up and coming pretty much anywhere, and then, you know, you come up here and really it's the only place to see somebody like that sometimes, especially in an intimate venue like that.
Right, exactly. And that's really what we were after, is just bringing the whole Nashville experience that happens down here every night, you know, to our hometown, and to bring entertainment back to North Idaho. You know, it was kind of in a weird place there for a minute. So I'm really proud of what the club has become, and I'm really proud of the shows that we've brought through.
You definitely should be proud of that. And as you're thinking back, kind of looking at all of this, is there anything that if somebody out there wanted to open up a bar and do this sort of thing, is there any advice that you could give them or something you wish you would have known before you pulled the trigger?
You know, I would just say you have to surround yourself with people you really trust. It's we haven't had a lot of stumbling blocks because Bob and I have such a close relationship, and getting into business with somebody is a lot like getting into a marriage. So we've been really successful as a partnership. We don't argue. We haven't had any even really disagreements. You know, we both have our lanes, and I would say, you know, you pick your swim lane and you stay in it. And the biggest thing I would say about anything, whether it's running a bar or any kind of a business or anything that you're trying to do, is the more of your ego that you can remove, the better off you're going to be, you know. And because when you remove ego, you're making room for good things to come into your life. And for, if you think you know everything, you're not going to learn anything. So you got to be willing to say, hey, I don't know what I'm doing here. And I've got no ego. Show me how to do this. Teach me how to do this, being a sponge. And that's how I've done everything. And it's really the thing that's gotten me through, you know, starting in North Idaho, where, I mean, my teachers and, you know, authority figures, not my parents, but people around, you know, would be like, man, this is never going to work for you. And I had girlfriends that said, this is never going to work for you. And I had, you know, people all around me who just said, this is never going to happen. And, you know, people will say whatever you're going to listen to. So you really just, if you can control your ego and be a sponge and get out of your own way and let good things happen, they do.
That is some fantastic advice, Jeremy. I mean, it really is. Kind of looking back at the journeys that I've taken and people that I know, I mean, that's really it. You got to surround yourself with good people and know what you want to do, and, you know, kind of put the haters to the side, I guess.
Yeah, and being clear and concise. You know, I think that people take clarity as aggression. You know, when if somebody says, "Well, I want to do this," and you just go, "Well, that's not a great idea. Let's." You know, think about this. And I think people, you know, can get butt hurt and things like that when it's like, look, let's not make anything personal. Everything is business. And let's talk about this in a productive way. And let's have fun doing this. Cause if it's not fun, I don't want to be a part of it. And if there's ego involved, I don't want to be a part of it. So if we can all win as a team that I'm in, if there's a bunch of, you know, me people in it, then I'm not into it.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And looking back at the at that video, you know, you were at the Nashville North, filmed the video. But something else about that video that jumped out at me, and I think a lot of people know this already, but you've got a bus that you take on tour, which is a little bit unique for an artist of your size. But how did that come about, and how did My Pure Hemp CBD get involved?
Yeah. So, man, you know, I was on the bus tour on the Cable Guy thing, got a record deal. When I got a record deal on Warner Brothers, you know, you've got a record label paying for your bus. And then when I lost my record deal, all that goes away. And so I went from the biggest comedy tour in the world to my own bus to touring out of a pickup again, a single cab, you know, Toyota pickup, and was trying to drive around the country, just getting people to listen to songs again. And so it was totally starting over. I'd lost a publishing deal, lost a record deal. I was getting divorced. It was just all of these things. And instead of, you know, getting mad or getting upset at circumstances, my whole thing was, I'm just going to let this make me better. I'm going to go out and I'm going to get better. And so I started going out and just trying to prove myself and doing the things that, you know, that put me in a better spot for success. And because I made room for that, you know, good things happened all around. So I worked my way out from a single cab pickup truck to a van, to a bigger van, to a Sprinter van, back into a bus that I bought, and I own my bus. And then we've got friends who've helped us along the way with fuel. You know, mypurehempcbd.com are friends of mine who got in on the HempWorks thing, and so they asked if they could be part of the tour. We've got a great relationship together, and it's something where it's been super mutually beneficial, because I get to help out my friends. They've got a thriving business, and it's something that I use. So the CBD stuff has been really beneficial for me, and so it just kind of made sense.
That clears that up, I think. No, that's awesome. I mean, I remember, you know, just kind of scrolling through your Instagram and seeing that at some point. And then, I mean, it really does, when you see somebody like yourself, who's very personable up on stage. And even if if anybody's run into you at a show, you're an extremely easy guy to talk to. So when you post something like that, I think a lot of people definitely listen to it. But I want to shift again this time to talk about your songwriting a little bit. What does your songwriting process look like? Are you kind of a guy that sits down by yourself and then goes into a co-write, or would you rather write by yourself or with a co-writer all the time?
It kind of varies. I started obviously by writing by myself, like everybody does. And then when you come to Nashville, you end up co-writing a lot, and you get a publishing deal, and now you're co-writing all the time. You're co-writing 5 days a week, and you're writing hundreds of songs and trying to find out who you are. And then for me, it kind of got to the point where I went from writing with all these different people all the time to not really being inspired by the people I was in a room with, and wondering why I was doing that. And so I was like, you know, I think I'm just going to whittle this crew down. Because when you have a publishing deal, that your publishing company schedules rights for you. So you write with people a lot of the time that you don't know, because they have a record deal, or because they've got a song on the radio, or because they just got a record deal, or people are trying to help them out. So it's one of those deals where you're kind of learning along the way. And then once I hit a point, I was like, well, I think I'm just going to write with, my little group of friends. I've got like 4 or 5 buddies, and I'm going to write with them. And that's what I'm going to do, because it was the most inspiring for me. So then during the pandemic, I started writing by myself again. So it's kind of just back and forth. And sometimes I'll have an idea where it's like, man, I got to take this idea to Rick Huckabee, or I got to take this idea to Casey Timmer, or Travis Howard, or, you know, whoever it may be, just because the vibe might fit each other really well, or the idea fits what you do well together. You know, me and my buddy Dan Olson wrote most of this new record together, and Dan and I before this really hadn't written at all. So it just kind of goes through ebbs and flows.
Well, and you mentioned a couple of guys there that fans of this podcast will actually know as former guests, Rick Huckabee, Travis Howard. How'd you get hooked up with those two?
I met Travis Howard through a guy over at ASCAP named Herky Williams. He, really good friend of mine, brought me over there from BMI. And he was like, man, do you know Travis? And I said, man, I don't. And he introduced us, and Travis had just come off all those Miranda Lambert hits, and we started writing a bunch of songs together. And he's just a great dude. I love the guy. We've been friends for like 15 years now. And then Rick Huckabee and I were on Warner Brothers together, and there weren't a ton of artists on that label at the time that I was like, yeah, I really want to hang out with these guys. I'm kind of weird about that. Like I've got a lot of friends, but my circle is very, very tight, and it's people I've known a long time. And I'm never, I've never been in a big hurry to add a bunch of people to that circle, you know? And so, Huck and I just hit it off, and we had so much in common. He's super approachable and super funny and great. One of the most talented guys in town. And thank God for him. We've been friends for since I've been here, 16 years. So I owe a lot to Huck, and he's made me a much better songwriter.
I could definitely see that. I mean, he's one of my favorite guests that we've talked to, just because he's so personable, and he's just an enjoyable person to have a conversation with.
He really is, man. He's the best. He's just such a great dude.
So we've got a couple of songs here, and you mentioned the album a little bit. We haven't really told anybody about that, but you do have you are working on a new project. Yeah. Are both of the songs that we have today, Cotton's Getting High and Withdrawals, off of that project?
Yeah, both are on the new record. I don't know how many songs it's going to have on it. We've recorded the first batch. I think we've recorded 6 or 7 for this record. And I don't know. I've written a lot over the last year, and so we'll see what comes on the back end of these. But it's my favorite group of songs I've ever put together, and wrote a lot of them over in Sweden with my buddy Dan Olsen. And it's just been a killer process from top to bottom. And the Average Joe's team is smashing it. They're just killing it. So Withdrawals has been out about 2 weeks, and I think we're over 100,000 views on the new video, and the streaming is up, and it's just an incredible thing to watch. So I'm excited to get back out on the road. I'm dying.
I bet, especially, it's been, God, man, it's been what, now a year that we've been in this, this COVID nonsense. Starting to open up a little bit though. So hopefully that'll get you back out there. Maybe get you to Sweden and get you some more inspiration over there.
Yes.
But we do have Withdrawals here, and I want to let everybody take a listen to it. Talk to us about how this song came together. It just came out at the beginning of February, right?
Yeah, it's 2 weeks old right now. And so we wrote this over in on a little tiny island right outside of Stockholm, Sweden. We were over there playing a music festival called Live at Heart, me and my buddy Dan Olsen from the band Sack Alliance. And we were playing, and there was a Swedish songwriter who came over named Linnea Lundgren. And she brought an oboe, and it was the weirdest experience ever. And we it was crazy.
You don't involve oboes and woodwinds in your songwriting process typically?
Not a lot. No, that was a first, man. But she was so vulnerable and so open, and it just fell out, man. We started playing that riff, and I had this idea, if thoughts turn into things, and I threw that out, and it just kind of took on a life of its own. And I'm really, really excited about it kind of blowing up right now.
Well, and you just put out a music video and a lyric video for the song. And I want to ask you about those, but first I want to give everybody a chance to listen to it so they know what we're talking about.
All right.
So here it is. It's brand new music from Jeremy McComb. It's called Withdrawals.
Yeah.
If thoughts turn into things, I'm thinking we should pay a tab and leave. Is so intoxicating, baby, I just might OD. Yeah, I'd only say then, baby, we'll keep you waiting. Shake.
only get when I can get a taste of your love. The more I try to score, the more I need to get the high I chase. Yeah, and I'm desperate, baby.
One it was Withdrawals, brand new music from Jeremy McComb. And first question that I have for you about the music video, why a bowling alley?
Because I'm a bowling alley 10.
No, solid answer.
No, I'm a huge fan of the movie The Big Lebowski. And I wanted to do a Big Lebowski themed video. And so Julian, our director, I told him, I'm like, I want to do something in the Big Lebowski. And he goes, that's crazy. I was thinking about a bowling alley. And I'm like, let's do it. So we've got a really old, really cool vintage bowling alley here called Donaldson Bowl. And so we went down there and shot it.
It's a great music video. It's fun. It's outside of, you've got some music videos that are just the music video. And this one really kind of has a story with it. What was the idea behind putting out the music video and the lyric video?
I think, just in an age that we're in right now of content where some people are more apt to watch a story-driven music video that's kind of goofy and fun and, in a bowling alley. And then I think there's some people that want to watch a lyric video. They want to hear the lyrics. They want to see the lyrics. They want to have their own interpretation of the song. And people just consume the consumption of music is so varied these days, from downloads or streaming to videos and lyric videos and covers and TikTok and all this stuff. So I think just putting out as much content as you can to inspire as many people as you can to enjoy the music is kind of the goal.
It seems to accomplish it. I mean, you put it out in different formats there, and you're right. I mean, I think that there's a different group that wants to watch the lyric video than the music video. But yeah. I think if you're out there listening to this, you definitely need to go find both of them, because they're unique in their own way. But the bowling alley video is fun to listen to. And they're both on your YouTube channel, right?
Yeah, both on YouTube, which is just YouTube official Jeremy McComb.
That's easy. What give everybody the rest of your social handles as well. That way they can follow you there as well.
On Instagram, it's at McCombover. And on Twitter, it's at Jeremy McComb, and jeremymccomb.com, all that stuff. Facebook is Jeremy McComb Music.
And without getting yourself in trouble with your label, do you have any idea when the project might come out? Just a general time frame that everybody can keep an eye on?
I don't. It's such an interesting, different platform than when I very first got started. It used to be, when you're going to release a single, you would go out on the road for a year and you would promote it to every radio station in the country. You would go to every station. You would meet every program director. You would play in the conference rooms, and then you would do the morning show and then fly to another city and do the afternoon show. And then it just never stopped. When I was on Warner Brothers, I was on a 2-year radio tour, and it was just hell on wheels. And now it's so different. It's like, you put out singles and, you know, they send it out like the Monday before it comes out, you shoot a music video, and then you watch your socials and you go out and you support it with touring. So I don't know when the actual full project will be out, but I would imagine that, you know, as we're rolling from this single to the next one, that we would be getting close, being on the third, hopefully this, you know, summer, maybe. I have no timeline. I have no idea.
That's okay. That just gives people more reason to go over and follow you on social. And you,
yes,
you also do something that's kind of cool on Instagram. Tell everybody about that.
The, are you the Daily Nooner? Is that what you're talking
about?
Yeah,
the Daily Nooner.
It started during the shutdown. I just got tired of sitting on my ass doing nothing. And so I, you know, I'm a little inappropriate anyway. Charmingly off color is what I prefer.
It's a good way to put it. I like it.
So I started this little live. I just go live on Instagram and play songs. And it started off with me doing my songs. And then I got so tired of me, I started just doing a bunch of cover songs. Then I would pick like a theme. And I did one today. It was 90s teen angst songs. So I was singing songs that, and, you know, I like, it's not songs that I know most of the time. So, you know, the pitch might be bad or my guitar might be out of tune. I don't give a shit. It's about having fun. And it's about connecting with people. And so today was, you know, 90s teen angst. I was doing Semisonic and Nirvana and, you know, all these different. The day before that, it was songs written by Liz Rose, who's just an amazing country songwriter. And the day before that, it was 90s country. So I try to do it daily. It doesn't always happen that way. And especially as we start to tour, it probably won't be daily again. But I do it at noon Central Standard Time, which if you're on the West Coast, it's 2 hours ahead. But it's just something for fun. And I throw it up there and we've got a core group of people who come every time I do it. And it's just fun.
It's a good time from the other side as well. And Jeremy, I feel like we keep talking for another hour. I've got a billion more questions, but I don't want to hold you up. So we'll definitely have to do this again in the future. But before we let you go, we end the show pretty much the same way we started. This, we call it the final four. And it's four questions that are just to make you think. Sound good?
All right. Sounds good.
It's time for the final four.
Okay, here we go. Question one. What's your favorite venue that you've ever played in?
Oh, man, it's too hard. favorite venue. I love the Wilma Theater in Missoula, Montana. It's probably my favorite venue.
That is a very kind of upper left U.S. kind of pick. Because I think a lot of people around here know exactly what you're talking about. And other people have absolutely no idea that that town even exists.
Yeah, it's one of the most beautiful theaters in America. The other one is the Fox Theater in Detroit. The Fox Theater in Detroit is beautiful. The Wilma Theater in Missoula, Montana are incredible. And then listening rooms, you know, I mean, the Boxcars. And there's just so many cool ones. But if I just had to say, hey, pick your favorite, it'd be the Wilma Theater.
Okay, how about this one? And you can use your phone to cheat if you want to. Who are your three most recently played artists on Spotify or Apple?
Oh, man. All right, I'm opening opening my account here. So I was listening to – it's so random. All right, so Jimmy Dean, Big Bad John.
Okay.
And then I listened to Name by the Goo Goo Dolls. And then I listened, where am I at? And then I listened to Bad Guy by Billie Eilish.
Kind of all over the place. You're not lying.
Yeah, I don't care about genre. I never have. I just love great songs.
And kind of circling back, I know I said I was out of questions for now, but that's kind of how you've approached this album, isn't it? Kind of.
Yeah.
More 100%. Songwritery, less genre specific.
Yeah. And that was the whole play on it. You know, I told everybody at the label, I was like, look, if you're looking for a country artist to sign, I'm probably not your guy. Even though I grew up in North Idaho, I grew up with around nothing but cowboys. My dad's a cowboy. I'm a country kid until I die. I'm a hillbilly in every sense of the word. I am a North Idaho. I'm an Idahoan to my core, but, I'm all over the place musically. I love Macklemore to, you know, some of the Dr. Dre to, you know, Sean Mullins, folk rock, Matt Nathanson, Ben Rector, to AJR, and it's just all over the place. Billie Eilish, and all around. If it's a great song, I want to hear it. I don't care what the genre is on it.
Well, that's definitely the most important part. You know, if it's a great song, great, play it for me. I mean, that's the my Spotify is the same way. I'm glad nobody's asked me that question, because there might be some embarrassing ones on there if I look back far enough.
Hey, dude, I got Mariah Carey, Always Be My Baby on loop. So don't feel bad.
Okay. That does make me feel a little better. Yeah. How about this one? What's your favorite on stage memory?
Oh. God, this is going to sound so, I mean, in recent memory, there's just been so many shows. There's been so many amazing things. I was given a certificate by, have you ever heard of the Saluting Marine?
He's a guy that
he would go to, they have this thing called Rolling Thunder in Washington, D.C., where like a million motorcycles roll through Washington, D.C., and it just sounds like thunder. This Marine stands at this intersection in the median and salutes every veteran as they ride by. He stands and salutes for like 12 hours. He tore all the muscles in his shoulder one time doing this.
Oh, geez.
If you've never seen him, check out the Saluting Marine. And he gave me a certificate for the work that we do with veterans and the Wounded Warrior Project and stuff one time on stage, which is amazing. The sold out, the show that comes to mind, the sold out show at Nashville North for, Cotton's Getting High was incredible. And the sold out show we did at the Wilma Theater with Kip Moore is probably one of my favorite shows of all time. There's just so many. I mean, the Blue Collar days were so incredible. I mean, there's too many, but in recent memory, those would be my favorites.
When you're 13, I feel like a lot of, especially those early memories that you're making,
could
probably rank right up there. But Jeremy, last question, and answer this however you want. If you could pick one thing for people to take away from this podcast or just from your music in general, what would it be?
To allow great things to happen in your life and to get out of your own way. Not to listen to people who are going to tell you you can't do it. People that are going to tell you that you're going to fail. People are going to tell you you're going to lose. And to have enough faith in yourself to bet on yourself and to not quit. And to realize that the real road to perseverance and to get what you want is realizing that the obstacles that lay in your path are opportunities for you to get better. And the obstacle is actually the way, because it makes you better. So to get better, push through, kick on, kick ass, and make them wonder why you're still smiling.
Kick on and kick ass. There you go. Words of wisdom from Jeremy McComb. Jeremy, man, thank you so much for jumping on here. We'll definitely do it again.
Thank you, brother. Can't wait.
Awesome. And that was another episode of the Tea Party Podcast. It's the country music podcast where you find new friends and new music like Jeremy McComb and his brand new single, Withdrawals.
Go tee off on the like button at facebook.com/teapartypodcast.
This has been a Tea Party Communications production. Theme music created by Jesse Quant. Announcer voiceovers by Jay Gwynn. And as always, hosted by Ty Pisani.